Welcome to episode 65 of the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. I'm your host, Sock Jig. You can follow me on Twitter at Sock Jig and on Instagram as well. On today's episode, I have an interview with CEO and co-founder of Tradeblock, the marketplace app where sneakerheads can trade sneakers, Bimo Gokomo. And he also goes by Beams, but I don't think I called him that during the interview. We talk about his journey into becoming a tech startup CEO and co-founder and how Tradeblock came to be, and the importance of a black-owned startup in the sneaker industry. We also talk about his relationship with angel investor Jason Maiden, and also the challenges that have come up, especially starting a tech startup right before COVID and now in the slowing sneaker economy. We also talk about what happened with the recent app UI changes that caused a lot of strong feedback from customers, and the subsequent reversals of those changes. And finally, we talk about the Sneaker March Mania promotion that they have going on. And that's how they initially reached out to me, because I, of course, have created sneaker backends before. We get into all that kind of details. And just to note that this conversation was originally recorded on February 29th and first published on March 11th. And now, my conversation with Bimo. My guest today is the CEO and co-founder of Tradeblock, a marketplace app where sneakerheads can trade their sneakers with other sneakerheads. Please welcome to the show, Bimo Gokomo. How are you doing, Bimo?
Living the dream every day, man. I appreciate you having me on. I'm excited for the conversation.
No, I wanted to talk about the overall kind of goal of Tradeblock and the app, some app experience details and kind of challenges. Not only in, you know, tech challenges, economy challenges, even like the recent UI changes and stuff like that, I wanted to bring up as well too. But first, a bit about you. Like, how was your journey? What is your journey from sneakerhead, sneaker enthusiast to becoming a tech CEO and like first time founder?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So, you know, I'd say my love of and relationship with sneakers goes back to really junior high. I grew up in a household that I like to describe it as like whatever is the very, very bottom line for being middle class. That's probably exactly where we were, just towing that line constantly. I'm also a first generation immigrant. I was born in Cameroon. I have an African father. So really, we were just a very, very frugal household. So a lot of the sneakers that were, you know, popular, desirable at the time, I kind of knew that that was a non-starter. A lot of my shoes up until I started to like get my own job and earn my own money was sort of like, all right, you know, what's available at Payless or what's available at the clearance rack at Ross or JCPenney. And some of y'all know, actually, that's some of the best places you could buy, especially hooping shoes. But,
right,
you know, I remember in seventh grade, my parents bought me a pair of Cheryl Swoop's signature shoe, the second shoe she came out with, which frankly actually is a pretty dope shoe. I was from Houston, so shout out to Cheryl Swoops in the comments. Like, she's a legend. However, as like a seventh grade boy, you don't really want to go to basketball practice wearing a woman's signature shoe. And, you know, at the time I was still getting my bearings and kind of learning who I was. And so, you know, I just remember being really self-conscious about it. Shout out to my team. Like, they really didn't give me nearly as much shit for it as I thought. But I remember going into eighth grade, taking a trip to the mall, went to Foot Locker, Champs, Finish Line, every shoe I like. My parents were like, non-starter, not paying $100 for a shoe. So, yeah,
$100, you know, I was crazy back then.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And so it was like, all right, well, let's go to Ross and get you some, you know, we had dress code. So it's like, let's get you some khaki pants and stuff. And I was like, well, let me just go see what's on the clearance rack. And there was a pair of all black T-Mac 2s that were $30. And I was like, yo, this is it. So that's always been one of my grails. Yeah, super tough with the patent leather that kind of swooped across over the top of the toe. And, you know, all of y'all will know and understand this. When you put a shoe like that on your feet and you know, go to school for the first time or wherever, you just feel like $1 million man. So, you know, that's the first shoe I really, really fell in love with. And I just grew up playing sports and particularly basketball. So, you know, naturally as a hooper, you can't avoid sneaker culture. So I worked at Finish Line as well. My two co-founders worked at Foot Locker. So, you know, junior high school, I was just always around sneakers. In college, I played basketball for 2 years, so continued to be around it. And then I finished my undergrad at UT. So I hooped at Dartmouth for 2 years, took 2 years off. And then I went to UT to finish my undergrad studying actually journalism and sociology. And then I've always been somebody who says, you know, follow your passions is a really difficult thing to do. I say follow your curiosity. And so when I graduated, there was an interesting opportunity to go create content for the design program at IBM. And I was like, I don't really know much about IBM, but I like technology. And frankly, like, you guys pay content creators a lot more than I would make going and, you know, being a journalist for like the local newspaper. So sure, why not?
So it was from a content creator point of view.
Yeah, exactly. So they were building out actually an internal content hub to try to teach the company about modern product design, because IBM is a 100-year-old tech company. And a lot of the way that they built products was, you know, the same way they were building products 30, 40 years prior. And so they were like, okay, we want to teach people what modern good product design looks like, but we also have to convince them to try these things out. And the best way to convince people to try something is to tell stories about other people who have tried that thing. And so they were like, we have this internal content outlet, but we don't have any content creators. Can you come and do podcasts, write blog posts, work on videos that talk about people who tried out these new modern product design, you know, approaches, and basically are like, hey, I was skeptical up front, but wow, I'm so glad we did this. And, you know, this is how I'm going to approach this going forward. So I was like, cool, sounds great. But, you know, during my time there, I think I just really fell in love with the process of building a product. You know, I like to say that at my core, I'm just a really curious person. And my favorite thing to learn about is people. It's like human behavior, human psychology, especially in groups. We become very, very interesting individuals, you know, when there's a bunch of us who all share a, you know, a way of thinking or a passion like sneakers. So as I started to realize, oh, product is really about understanding people and human psychology, I just fell in love with it. And so, you know, how I ended up back at Tradeblock was my co-founder, Darren.
How was like the jump from like getting, you know, your kind of first job in tech world at IBM to like tech co-founder? Because that is a big leap that doesn't always happen. You know, there's usually a lot of steps in between working at other tech places. So how did that process go?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been in Austin for like the past 10 years and Austin is a pretty active like startup ecosystem, especially for tech companies. So naturally, I ended up spending a lot of time around people who are in entrepreneurship. One of my best friends was a founder at the time. And, you know, we used to link up, and I'm revealing how much of a nerd I am, but Settlers of Catan is like one of my favorite games of all time. It's a strategy board game. Some of y'all will know, some of you won't. But, you know, there was a portion in time where two or three nights a week we would meet up, play two or three games of Catan, and 90% of what we would talk about is like his product or startups or ideas and things like that. So, you know, I just started to realize I would love to do this for myself, but I don't quite know what would be worth investing that amount of time, energy, and frankly, like stress into. And I had a good thing going at IBM. So I was like, let me stay here. Let me continue to earn and save money and learn. Like, I was surrounded by incredibly smart people who were always, you know, super willing to share and just like put you on free game. But, you know, my third year, fourth year at IBM, I think I started to realize I feel like I really understand this product space well. And, you know, if given the opportunity, I think I could do a really good job leading a product. But when you don't have kind of a formal background in that space, there's a lot of work convincing people like, hey, I'm the content guy. You should really put me in charge of your whole product, though. You know, people are like, you're cool, you're smart, we like you, but nothing about your track record tells us we should give you this role. And so it was
It's the same challenge when you start like your own and then getting tech funding, right?
Exactly.
So how did you cross that divide, that chasm then?
Yeah. So basically, as I was trying to find, you know, product lead roles at IBM, my co-founder, Darren, who I've known, you know, since I was in seventh grade, me and my two co-founders, we all grew up together, played sports together. He pulled up to Austin and basically pitched me on Tradeblock. He was like, hey, you know, Tony and I have been talking. we've seen kind of the emergence and the blow up and glow up of StockX and GOAT. And some of you guys will know this if you kind of read any of the origin story of TradeBlock before. But the original idea for TradeBlock goes all the way back to 2010. Tony, our other co-founder, is a huge fantasy sports guy. And, you know, we were also very into sneakers. And one day he was kind of like, you know, it'd be dope is like if we just merge these two things and, you know, created almost like a fantasy sports type experience, but where you're trading your real shoes with other collectors. At the like time, the we were young ESPN. And dumb. And exactly, yeah.
Like ESPN the ESPN trade machine, yeah.
Still exists today if anybody wants to go check it out.
Yeah, no, I remember at 5-6 years ago, it would be on that thing all the time, you know, around the trade deadline especially.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Tony had that idea, but we were 17, you know, 18 years old. They were going into their senior year of high school. I was getting ready to start my freshman year, you know, playing basketball. So it wasn't an idea that we took seriously. But, you know, fast forward 10 years, we were 10 years more mature. We had all spent some time in the professional world, building up different skill sets and just, quite frankly, putting our priorities in order. And so he was like, look, the sneaker space and particularly the secondary market for sneakers is, you know, about as hot and as healthy as it's ever been. But none of these companies seem to have any interest in doing the thing that we talked about a decade ago, and that's facilitating trading. So it just started as like a, hey, we owe it to ourselves to see if there's a there there. And, you know, as we started going to sneaker cons, pitching people on the idea, you know, we realized that a lot of people were like, yeah, you know, kind of field of dreams. Like, if you build it, I'll come. That sounds super dope. I love sneakers. And, you know, playing around with my sneaker collection, playing fantasy with my sneaker collection sounds like something I would totally do if it existed. So, you know, we said, okay, let's go out and try to do this. And to your question about, you know, getting funding and all of that, that could be a topic for a whole nother podcast in and of itself. You know, I'd say I'm fortunate in that a lot of the relationships I built during my time at IBM ended up being really, really valuable when we moved into the startup world. So one of my last bosses at IBM, a guy named Phil Gilbert, he actually ran the design program for the whole company. And he was only working at IBM because his last company had been acquired by IBM. So he was a startup guy. And, you know, I was working for him at the time that Darren came and pitched me on TradeBlock. And he was like, yo, this is really dope. Like, IBM will be here. You only get so many opportunities to go and try to do something like this. So it was cool because I kind of was expecting him to be like, hey, you're, you know, I was in this kind of apprenticeship role working for him. And the idea is like, you'll go on to be leadership at IBM. He's like, No. Go do this thing. And basically, not only do you have my support, but I'll be your first check. And then, you know, he had a really solid network of folks he had worked with through some of his ventures. And then, you know, quite frankly, like all entrepreneurs, the first thing you got to do is go to all of your friends and family, you know, with your hat out begging for money. And then we also came out of pocket. You know, I'd like saved up a bunch of money from IBM. And a lot of that money, you know, went into the first version of our product. Right. You know, you gotta take risks. So
no, you have to. You have to be. You have to have. You know, like you said, you have to talk with your network. You have to get lucky as well too. Sometimes you have a network and the timing might not work. But it's you, the personality you bring to build that network, to have these connections in the first place. So it kind of takes everything and all that stuff. And like I said, luck as well.
Absolutely. 1,000%.
So you start the app, you're able to secure a little bit of funding. And this is in like 2018 or so you started, or 2019?
Yeah. So Darren pitched me September of 2019. I quit my job summer of 2020. So actually, this is like 3 or 4 months after the pandemic started and shut everything down. And there's a great story about the conversation I had with my dad, again, who's like African father, who's all about like stability. I've always been the kind of guy who's like, yo, I'm bouncing all over the place. So he's like, you finally got a stable job at a company I know, you're doing well, and you quit your job in the middle of a pandemic, which at the time, if you guys remember, like nobody knew where that was heading. Like there's a lot of people who are like, this is it. This is the apocalypse. Like nothing is, you know, nothing will ever be the same. But I just had such a strong belief in what we were doing. And I think, you know, a strong confidence as us as executors, where I was like, hey, I wouldn't bet on any other group of guys in the same way that I would bet on us. And, you know, what's the worst that could happen? We go out, we fail, we learn, and we return to, you know, jobs at other places. And, you know, quite frankly, a failed entrepreneur, like, that's a great thing to have on your resume. You learn so much in that process. So
that summer of 2020, like, there was a lot, like no one knew what was going to happen, which direction it would take, if it was just 1 month or 2 months. And then for a while we thought, like, you know, it's going to crash the economy, it's going to crash like everything. But instead it kind of did the opposite, at least in tech wise, because everyone started investing in tech because everything was like online and interest rates were a little bit lower back then as well too. Yeah. So it ended up being like a real boom where everyone thought it might be like a slower time. Is that what happened out there when you were kind of securing, that people were like, okay, this is a good idea? Sneakers were still much more booming at that time as well too. Is that what happened when you guys went out there and pounded the pavement for the startup investment first round of funding?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, as everybody knows who's in the sneaker space, like, COVID for us was actually in incredible timing from a business standpoint, because it did a couple things. You know, one, once the pandemic started, sneaker cons, sneaker meetups, all of those things, all of a sudden, all stopped, right? And so a lot of the, you know, the things that sneakerheads would do to connect with one another and to really just engage and, you know, feed that passion for sneakers was no longer available. We were all sitting in our houses trying to figure out, what do I do with my time and how do I keep myself from going crazy? And like you said, a lot of that was like, okay, well, what are the things that I can do online? And I think one thing that we hit on with Tradeblock, which was intentional, was we sort of said, like, look, marketplaces are great. They serve a role and that's being fulfilled really well. But, you know, one of the core kind of premises of Tradeblock, and I'll probably say this two or three more times before we end this, you know, conversation, is like, sneaker culture is actually about everything that happens in between those transactions. Like, right, vast majority of people who love, like, who are sneakerheads, not buying the shoe because of what I think it might be worth in the future. I'm buying the shoe because I love something about it. The designer, the materials, the storytelling.
Looking fresh in the streets, right? Like, nothing's ever going to beat that, looking good in a good pair of kicks in the streets, right?
Exactly. And just by nature of, you know, the platform itself, like, to be able to trade, you have to be able to see what other shoes does someone have in their collection. You have to be able to interact, go back and forth with them, learn about what they like, learn about what they don't like, etc. And so I think one of the things that was great for Tradeblock was it was not only a new and fun way of, you know, acquiring sneakers at a time where all of a sudden everybody was stuck at home, but it was also a way for you to connect with and interact with other members of the community all around the country. And so I think for a lot of people, it helped fill some of that gap of, you know, I can't go to SneakerCon. Hell, I can't even go up to my local, you know, consignment shop where I used to chop it up with other sneakerheads. So I think for us, it was fortunate timing. And it was definitely, I think, a big part of why we were able to get the traction we got early on. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you're raising money, traction is everything. So once we were able to show some traction, show, hey, people are willing to do this, people are willing to pay for it, we're seeing healthy growth, and we're seeing, you know, I think one of the most interesting insights we discovered was, like, you have resellers and they play a certain purpose. And if you look at a traditional marketplace, basically all the shoes listed, or the vast majority, are coming from people who are actively reselling. But for every one reseller, there's 10 folks like you or I who's like, no, I just love sneakers. I have another job, so I don't need to be selling on a regular basis. But the second you tell me that by listing my sneaker on this platform, I will open myself up to trade possibilities all the time, every day, it's like, cool, say less. And so, you know, a big part of our business is just this idea of unlocking dormant inventory. Because even if you're not a seller, you may be sitting on a ton of shoes. And, you know, for me, my rotation is maybe like 4 or 5 shoes, realistically. Every once in a while, I'll pull something out for the right occasion and the right fit. But 90% of my collection is just there, you know, gathering dust. And every once in a while, I'll look at it. So I think that was the other thing that intrigued people was, yeah, I like this shoe, but there's plenty of other shoes that I like even more. And if I'm not getting any value from it, why not, you know, put it into the game and see what happens?
So that was like a deliberate choice from the very beginning to make, you know, not only like community part of the app, like just the ability to DM another person is not something you're going to see on GOAT or StockX or other like sneaker apps. So like That was by choice from the very beginning that, you know, we wanted to be, like you said, the in between, the it's for the people for community building, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even the name, you know, Trade Block, like there's a part of that which was, hey, sneakers and sneaker culture are, you know, basically adjacent to sports culture. And everybody knows the concept of like, hey, these are the players on the trade block. But actually, and you'll kind of see it in like the grays and our branding, and there's a lot of stuff we have that's like blacks and grays, et cetera. That actually is kind of a metaphor that we drew around the bigger brand, which is like, we want to see ourselves as the block itself. Like we're the corner, right? We're the place where all of these passionate people come to congregate, to connect with one another and build relationships. Like we just want to be the ether and the medium for that. So that was super intentional of like, even if you guys don't want to trade, if we can create a place where you can build meaningful relationships, that alone is going to be, you know, something worth building and something that has value. So like my favorite stories, I was talking to one of our top traders the other day and he's like, yo, I've got a group text with like 8 people on it. They are the people who I am closest to in the world these days, who I interact with the most. I've never met any of them in person. They're all people I've traded with on TradeBlock. And we're always just constantly talking about releases and trades and would you do this or would you do that? You know, there was another guy who was, you know, he's like, yo, I'm 55. Like I was heavy in sneakers in the 80s. I kind of fell out of it, you know, and I've recently been trying to rekindle my relationship with my son and my grandson. And, you know, the number one thing I could connect with them on, sneakers. So I found out my grandson was using this crazy app. I started using it and it's, you know, been one of the most powerful things for building our relationship. Like at the end of the day, those things don't show up on your P&L or don't show up in your revenues, but you know, those are the sorts of stories that keep me going and get me excited every morning.
We mentioned sports culture as well too. And one of the things I wanted to ask was about like, you guys are a black owned tech startup, which is rare, especially in the sneaker world itself too. Like how important was that to you to, you know, kind of make the sneaker industry look like the people who created the culture?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, TradeBlock has a mission and a vision, right? So, you know, our mission is about basically, you know, the service that we provide. It's about, you know, access. So making it easier for people to get their hands on sneakers in a more affordable way. It's about community, which I've already talked about. And it's about love of the game, right? You know, buying and selling is one thing, but we love sneakers for all of these other reasons. And how do we give people a way to really engage in sneakers in a way that's broader and takes those things into account? But our vision statement is actually, it has nothing to do with sneakers or sneaker culture. It's all about basically building the next generation of black and brown technologists, creatives, and entrepreneurs. So, you know, the thing for me was when you look at a space like sneakers, it's undeniable that this culture only exists because of black and brown people who were really, really passionate about it early on, right? Before it was marketable, before it made a ton of money, before some Adidas execs from Germany, you know, came to a Run DMC concert and were like, what the hell is going on? We got to invest in this. It was a bunch of black and brown people, many of whom, you know, from lower socioeconomic status, who were like, this is something I love.
Looking and fresh in the streets, as I said, right?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and I think it was something that, yeah, we kind of just had a chip on our shoulders about is like, man, it is wrong that this space is dominated by companies that if you look at their, you know, executive teams, et cetera, they don't look like the people that they're serving. You know, and we were very much struck by, all right, we're going to all of these sneaker cons as founders, pulling up ourselves. And man, I can't tell you how many times, like, this was both dope, but it was also kind of sad because the first version of TradeBlock was called Astrolab, and we were an Instagram page, and we didn't put our faces out there. So we started to build a following. So, you know, there were people who already knew about us. And I can't tell you how many times, like, we would meet somebody and they'd be like, oh, y'all are the Astrolab guys? And then they kind of awkwardly be like, I didn't know you looked like that, right? It's just, there's an automatic expectation. Oh, you know, maybe these are like some white kids who went to Stanford or, you know, some Asian kids who went to NYU and nothing's
wrong. The typical
wrong
tech nerd kind of stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, some of my best friends are those people. But at the end of the day, you know, I think the thing that's most important for me is oftentimes black and brown kids, that the things that were shown really push us to be consumers, right? Go buy this stuff, go wear this stuff, and then let us make you the thing that we market to go make more money off of this. And I'm like, look, it's cool to be a consumer, but you can also be an owner. And so it wasn't just about being a person of color running this company. It was also about being our full selves, right? In every arena, not just when I go to SneakerCon, but when I go to Silicon Valley and I'm pitching tech VCs, I'm wearing J's, I'm wearing streetwear, I'm wearing my hoodie, I've got my dreads down, right? Because at the end of the day, you got to reset people's stereotypes. Right. And if there's one thing that I'm really, really passionate about in this world, it's going into a room, knowing that there's going to be three or four assumptions you make about me and my co-founders before we talk, and then leaving that room and knowing you're going to be like, holy shit, the next time I see a couple young Black kids with dreads, you know, like, I'm going to assume those guys have the juice because this was a conversation unlike anything I've ever had. So, you know, I'm very, very passionate about kind of resetting those stereotypes in the tech world, but at the same time, showing those 11, 12-year-old kids who we were, you know, 15 years ago, hey, this is not a dream. This is not looking at Zuckerberg on Facebook and being like, man, that's crazy. That could never be me. It's like, oh man, this cat talks like me. This cat hooped like me. This cat dresses like me, you know, very down to earth person from a similar background to me. Like, storytelling is the most powerful thing in the world. And when you see somebody else's story that represents your own, all of a sudden it changes the way you view what's possible. So at the end of the day, like, if we can do that, no matter where Tradeblock ends up, like, that's a win. And I'm going to be proud of the work that we did.
Yeah. And you personally, and I'm sure your co-founders, like you said, you had to kind of step behind the anonymous Astrolab name and kind of show yourself and, you know, have those discussions, like you said, in these meetings, when especially when getting funding and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. I read that one of your angel investors is Jason Maiden in the sneaker industry. If you don't know, he was early on worked at Jordan Brand and then worked for Fear of God and Fear of God Athletics as well, too, I think. And that was back at Jordan Brand. Like, what was it like talking with someone like that, getting him to kind of join on board and see the vision?
Man, I don't know that I have words to actually describe that in a way that captures it. If you guys don't know Jason Maiden, I would just encourage you to Google him and read or watch anything you find. One, I don't know that I've ever met somebody who is more like prolific is the first word that comes to mind. You know, he does so many things. Like, sometimes I'm like, look, Jason, stop lying. There's five versions of you. You figured out how to clone yourself. And you got one Jason over here doing this, the second one over here doing that. But I think what makes that so much more impressive is he doesn't do anything without an insane amount of thoughtfulness and intentionality. So, you know, I'd say when I was like prepping for this interview, I was thinking about this question and trying to really capture it. And there was two things that I hit on. One was, you know, staying rooted in your first principles and who you are, and bringing your full self to the table no matter what the circumstance. There are times where it's easier or quite frankly more advantageous to put on a mask or put on a series of masks because, you know, for example, this person is going to have certain stereotypes about me if I pull up and I am my full self. So let me try to be the person that I think, you know, they want to see. You know, having somebody like Jason who has gone through that in so many different aspects of his life, professional and otherwise, who can then kind of pour into you and say like, no, look, exactly who you are is what makes you and makes the things you do so valuable. And the second you start to lose that, you know, you're basically sacrificing long-term success for short-term gains. So, you know, I think one of the challenges of being a founder and particularly like Black founders, and adding on a layer of building a business that's like never existed before, right? It's not like we're like, oh, we're the Uber of this or we're the DoorDash of that. Right. Like, nobody had ever built a trading platform before. So
yeah, it was like kind of limited to Facebook groups as someone would be a middleman and there would have to be a lot of trust involved. And so then, you know, as an app, as a platform, you're the one that has to gain the trust of customers, right?
1,000%. So, you know, it can be a very scary and lonely world. Like the amount of times you ask yourself the question, like, am I crazy? And like, what the hell am I doing? And all of these ideas I have, like, do I really think any of this is going to work out? So I think, you know, probably the number one thing I'd say for Jason is just every time you talk to him, he pours into you in a way that you are just like ready to run through three brick walls and are just so rejuvenated in terms of like your confidence in who you are and bringing that person to every situation. So that's the first thing that I'd say. And then the second thing I'd say is like allowing yourself to be vulnerable. Like what I just talked about, a lot of founders won't admit that, you know, building a company is a scary, lonely, painful thing a lot of the time, right? Everybody has to put on an air, you know, everybody wants to act like, oh, shit, sweet, my company is doing awesome. Even when behind the scenes, you're like, yo, I don't know how we're going to get payroll next month. So, you know, I think when you allow yourself to be vulnerable, one, it takes a lot of that weight off of your back. But two, you know, it creates an opening for other people to help you out. And I think at the end of the day, for anybody who's considering building something or becoming a founder, like that's so, so, so important. If you're really worried about looking like you're successful, then all of the challenges you actually have in real life, you're going to continue to deal with on your own. It's when you can admit, hey, I have no idea what I'm doing in this part of my business, or I thought I was so right about this and I was completely wrong and now I'm questioning everything. You know, if you can admit those things to others, you're going to, one, end up surrounding yourself with people who actually are truly there for you, who aren't just there because of what they think you are and what they think your company is, but you'll actually then, you know, be able to tap into, you know, really powerful, like smart people who have been through a lot of those same things. So I think that was another thing, you know, early on that I took away from J-May was like, man, for as successful as you are and, you know, people's perception of who you are, you know, from afar, when you interact with him, he's the most authentic, most genuine person, and he'll be the first to tell you all the things that he struggles with. And, you know, that was just something that I hadn't experienced in the professional world in that way. So something I try to embody myself as well.
If he's saying you got to be your authentic self, you know, your mask is off. And then if your mask is off, you're also opening yourself to be more vulnerable and things like that. But you need a network like that to consult. And so, yeah, no, I was very just curious. I asked you about Jason Maiden because I wasn't even sure if you would answer it because some of the stuff could be very private. And, you know, obviously I'm not going to ask about private conversations and things like that. And so I was glad that you were able to talk about it and kind of, yeah, someone who has this long history working at Nike and Jordan and Adidas and been in those rooms and talk with those people. And sometimes maybe he's like the only black person in that room and maybe other times there's more. But so there's a lot of experiences from those 20 years. And when talking with you at a tech startup, there's a lot of insight that you can get from people like that. And as well, the IBM Phil that you talked about as well, too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Man, when people are willing to give you free game, lean in.
I wanted to ask about the app as well, too. Ballpark, is it mostly used sneakers being traded on there or is it mostly new ones? I was wondering what the kind of divide was for that.
Yeah. So it's a little bit of both. You know, I think my marketing team here would probably want me to plug our end of year review from 2023. So part of my answer is if you haven't looked at it yet, you can actually go to TradeBlock and click on our marketing banner. We have kind of 2023 year in review that covers a lot of these things. But short answer is it's about like a 70-30 as far as like new to used. So we see a little bit of both, but it was really important to us that basically we handled both, right? I'm, for example, somebody who is really big on trading for used shoes. Like as much as I'm not a reseller, you know, if I get a shoe that's worth $700 or $800, it's so hard for me to just psychologically un-DS that I'm like, look, I would much rather trade for something that's used so that I don't feel bad when I put it on my toe. And, you know, you can also get better deals that way. Like a VNDS shoe, you can probably get for 70 or 80% of its quote unquote market value. So, you know, your trades go a little further. But, you know, again, you should definitely check out that 2023 year end review. But to just give you an example, About 2/3 of our trades are new shoes for new shoes. About 1/4 of our trades are new shoes for used shoes. And then about 10% are used for used.
Okay. Yeah. And you know, there's always going to be a certain market of people that will, like, I know people who don't want to trade for or buy used shoes at all. So it's like, there's a challenge there as well too, of like, are you going to try to win over those people, or are you just going to focus on the people that were, you know, if you have that mental block, it's quite the challenge to kind of break that, right? Obviously you can say things like it's way cheaper and things like that, like 80% of market value and things like that. So, overall, like how, you know, when we talked about it during the COVID time and you guys had, as a tech startup, you guys had pretty good growth early on. How was it dealing with the kind of the slowing economy and then the down market in the sneakers as well too? How did that affect you guys? Did trade slow down, or was it the opposite of where, you know, people were not buying new sneakers and using trade block more?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think the entire market saw like a decrease in activity overall. You know, we definitely saw an impact on our trade volume. You know, while I think there are people who are like, yo, I'm in the space and I'm going to be here no matter what the market looks like, those people continued to trade, and some of them actually started trading more. But I think what we all also recognize is when the market was, you know, bubbling, there were people who stepped into the space who, you know, weren't here for the love of the game, if you will. And again, I'm someone who's sort of like, hey, I'm not here to pass judgment. Like, if you were here because you're like, hey, this is a good opportunity, you know, there's a lot of hustlers who, like, you know, are people who don't come from much, who saw an opportunity to come up and you know, did really well for themselves and their families. But as the market came down, more of those people are going to exit the space. So, you know, I think as far as how it impacted us, we certainly saw a little bit of a decline in our volume. And, you know, from a business standpoint, it was actually a really good forcing function for us to be like, hey, where are there any areas where we can be more efficient, right? Where we can look at how we're spending our capital, and is this really a critical thing or not? Is there a way that we can do this process smarter, more efficiently, et cetera? But besides that, like, honestly, not much has changed for us. And again, I'll go back to some of the stuff I said earlier. Like, the vast majority of sneakerheads are buying shoes not because of how much they think they might sell them for later on. It's because they love shoes. So, like, no matter what the market is doing, there's somebody out there who has some shoes you want and wants some shoes you have. Again, not because of what they're worth, but because those sneakers are particularly meaningful to that person, right? Maybe it's the storytelling, maybe it's the materials, maybe it's the designer. In a lot of cases, you know, it's the nostalgia, it's the memories that you have tied to that particular shoe. But regardless, that doesn't change, right? And I was thinking about this podcast interview. I ended up looking at some of the stuff that I had, like, written in the past about this. And, like, way back in 2020, like, early 2020, before we even had a beta, I wrote a journal entry about, like, what is it we're trying to build and why are we trying to build it? So I actually thought it would be actually most appropriate to just read the end of that, because I think it answers this question well. And what I wrote, again, this is like January 2020. So, oh my God, more than 4 years ago now. It feels like a year. I'm like, oh my God, we've been doing this almost 5 years. But I wrote, we want to bring back the excitement of the hunt by focusing on collectors and collections rather than resellers and individual goods. We want to connect sneakerheads with one another so that they can work together to curate their collections and build real relationships rooted in a shared passion for sneakers and sneaker culture. And most of all, we want to give sneakerheads, particularly those who may not be able to spend hundreds of dollars a week on new shoes, a different and more affordable way to acquire sneakers to make sure that the most passionate members of this community are able to continue taking part in the rich culture that they themselves created in the first place. Buying and selling is cool, but sneaker culture is about everything that happens in between those purchases. And that's ultimately what we're all about. So I'd say, yeah, you know, your numbers are going to go up and down. Your revenue is going to go up and down. But I think the most successful companies have a really, really strong core mission and nucleus. And so none of that has changed. You know, we're still in the game to build the best community and the best trading experience for folks. And frankly, markets are cyclical. So, you know, we're down now, but we feel like if we continue to focus on, you know, our North Stars there, whenever that market circles back around, we're going to be in an awesome position to take advantage of it.
Just for my non-tech audience, North Star is like a, you know, your mission statement kind of thing. And so I think I had said the word North Star in some emails that I said to you. And so I always have to remember that, you know, there's non-tech sneakerheads listening to this as well too.
And that's why you're a good podcast host.
I also wanted to ask, you know, speaking about that, you know, you have to be adaptable to the marketplace and users, but you also have to be adaptable related to feedback you get from your customers. And I was going to ask about the recent UI changes that you guys made that you got a lot of feedback from customers. I know people that I follow and who use Tradebaka heavily did not like some of the recent app changes that you guys made. And so from what I saw is you have reverted most of them, but I wanted to ask, like, what happened? How did that happen? What was behind all that?
Yeah. So I'd say, you know, the first thing I'd say is like a key part of building something, especially something that's never existed, is like experimenting and taking risks. Sometimes those experiments pay off, sometimes they don't. So, you know, a little bit more detail there. We spent the better part of last year rebuilding our product. And actually, the main motivation for that was less about the app experience and the UI and more about everything that happens under the hood. So how it works, how our database was structured. You know, this is getting a little bit into the tech world, but basically, when you build a beta product, you're optimizing for how quickly can we get something out there that allows us to start gathering feedback and seeing if it's worth investing more in this thing. And naturally, you know, over time, you keep sort of bolting things on to that original beta, which again was not built to be a scalable, streamlined product. So after
you had accumulated tech debt.
Exactly. So after a while, you start to realize, like, we want to make a really simple change, and all of a sudden, it's, you know, taking way more time than it should and randomly impacting other parts of the app where it's like, why did this thing even impact that thing in the first place? So we sort of said, okay, you know, we've proven product market fit. We have a solid user base. You know, for us to be successful over the next 5 years, we got to bite the bullet and rebuild basically the guts, the engine of this product. As part of that process, we said, hey, there's some, you know, there's some things that we want to experiment with as far as, you know, how the front end, basically how the interface that you interact with is designed. And frankly, you know, as I look back on it, there's two things that I think we did wrong. One was we didn't talk to enough people as we were playing around with those various experiments. You know, we had conversations here and there, but we could have been much more intentional about putting some of those design choices in front of a broader group of our users. And I think we would have been a little bit less aggressive with that experimentation. And two, I think we did too much at once, right? It's one thing to change one area of the app, but, you know, we kind of fundamentally changed the home experience, you know, the search experience, a lot of key areas. So I think even if any one of those experiments actually may have been, you know, something that people liked, I think if you deal with three or four things all changing underneath you, it's just really hard to actually decide, is this a change I like? Because you're just trying so hard to get your bearings because all of a sudden everything's changed. So, you know, what I'd say is like, actually my, the guy who runs our Twitter, I think posted an incredible meme, like a couple days after that release, which is, if you guys know that, like, not gonna lie, I'm getting cooked right now. Like that was the reality. And I'll tell you, as a founder, like, it certainly does not feel good when you get it wrong. And when people are very, very loud about that, you know, I had a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of anxiety, like, a lot more than I usually have, naturally. But you know what I'd say is like, what was super dope about that experience was, to your point, how much like really clear, rich, valuable feedback we got from our members as a result of it, right? You know, it made it so clear that, hey, what you guys had built is actually really, really good, right? And there was a few signals that we got of, here are things that actually we do want to be a little bit different. Here are some things that we like about what you put in this new experience. But fundamentally, what we want is something that is 90% the same as what you've had before, just with some of these enhancements. And so we basically said, cool, you guys have made this very clear. You know, however much we may have liked or not liked some of those changes we made, it doesn't matter. Like, at the end of the day, we're building this product for you guys. And if this is what you're saying you want, this is what you're going to get. So, you know, I'd say the other thing that was actually really dope was like, just, it was a really interesting example or sort of illustration of like how much our core community really rocks with us. Because some people were very upset. Like, I'll give you one good example. He's one of our top traders. I won't name him here because I don't know if he would want to be named or not. But he started a petition of like, please revert to the old version of the app. And I actually was like, yo, as much as, again, we're getting cooked right now, I was like, guys, we've built something that's so meaningful to this person that he, and he's not somebody who spends a lot of time on sneaker Twitter or any of that. He's kind of like, yo, I'm behind the scenes. I'm just a watcher. But he was so passionate about what we had created before. He said, I'm going to go out and start a petition to try to get you to go back to what you had before. And while that doesn't feel good as far as what it means for what you've built, it feels amazing in so much as it's a reflection on how much those people loved what we had already created. So, like, I can't tell you how many conversations we had in the weeks after that release where people were like, yeah, this ain't it, but like, I love what you guys have brought to the space. And I've had nothing but positive interactions with you guys since I started, you know, on this platform and in this community. So like, at the end of the day, I'm passionate. I don't like a lot of the changes y'all have made, but I'm going to continue to use the app and tell you how I feel because I want to see y'all win. You know, I think the worst thing that could have happened would have been radio silence, right? Of like, yeah, well, this thing wasn't meaningful enough for me to even care that y'all made these changes. So yeah, that's the way that I look at it. And
when you're a nameless and faceless company, you can kind of get away with that. But when you're, like we talked about, mask off and you're front and center, and you're going to have to respond, and people will ask you these questions, and like, you know, you could have just said, no, this is the new UI and this is how it is going to be, and deal with it, and then dealt with the consequences, right? But it takes a certain, you know, a company doesn't have a personality, only people have a personality, but like,
right.
How the company operates depends on those people running the company, right? So like,
facts. You know, and as a founder, if you're not willing to go out in front of the firing squad and ask the question, like, yo, tell me what sucks, don't tell me what you like. That's cool. You'll tell me what you like regardless. Tell me what sucks, and that's how we get better. So
right.
It is always painful. You know, your product is in many ways like a child, you know, that you've created, that you've brought into this world. Like, this is one of the things that's a challenge for me, but I spend more time with Tradeblock than I spend with my son, who's a year old. So just to give you a sense of how much you pour into these things that you've created, like, that never feels good. But again, you got to open yourself up to that. And that's the only way, you know, that you get better. So what I will say is, we nailed the under the hood part that you guys can't see. So it's been really dope just to see how much faster we've been able to iterate after that point in time. So, you know, we're back to doing releases like every 2 weeks. We've got one that's coming out tomorrow that I'm super excited about, that's got some really exciting features in it. And our roadmap, literally over just like the next 2 or 3 months, just has me so, so hyped. And it's stuff that like, hey, we can now do this in a week. This thing would have taken us 6 weeks before. So what we told our users is, hey, appreciate you rocking with us and, you know, kind of pushing through the storm. But just trust us when we say things are going to, you know, continue to improve, and you're going to start seeing not only improvements to kind of the fundamental experience, but new features and new experiences that you guys have asked for a long time that we can finally deliver on.
Yeah. You know, as a developer myself, I know that, you know, end customers are not going to care about a refactor. Unless it makes things faster. And so if that's what it happens here, if the app is more responsive and faster, that's what customers will care about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what's next for Tradeblock? I know I wanted to talk about this Tradeblock Sneaker March Mania promo that you're doing as well too, but what's next for Tradeblock, the app, going forward? Is it set to stay in sneaker world? Do you have big plans, like a 5-10 year plan to get into other markets like StockX and others have done? Or is it kind of let's stay in sneaker world where trading makes the most sense?
Yeah, you know, we've always had it somewhere in our roadmap to expand to other categories. You know, but for kind of the market downturn, not just in sneakers, but, you know, kind of in the economy more broadly, that plan was a little bit more aggressive. But we sort of said, hey, at times like this, what you really want to do is double down on kind of your, you know, your core customers, your core verticals, et cetera. So all those other categories are still something that we think about and that we'll eventually get to. But, you know, for now and, you know, anytime in the near to midterm, there's just a lot of work that we still feel like we can do in the sneaker space, you know, to create a better product for the sneaker community specifically. And even as we go to, you know, sneaker cons and sneaker events, I'd say like roughly half of the people there still are hearing about Tradeblock for the first time. So, you know, I think we not only have a lot of opportunity for improvement as far as improving the existing experience for our existing members, but I think we have a lot of room to grow as well, just staying in sneakers. So, you know, for the next couple quarters, that's really going to be our focus. And just to hit on your other question of some of the things that are coming, you know, here in the coming months or whatever. So in our release tomorrow, there's two things I'm really excited about that I've wanted to see in our product for a really long time. One is the initial beta release of what we're calling offer ideas. So if you use Tradeblock, one thing you may have experienced is like, all right, I know what I want, but a lot of the work and frankly, like the mental load is like, what should I offer? You know, it's not just trying to balance the market value, but it's, you know, determining like, what am I most willing to trade? What is this person going to want? What does a good trade look like, et cetera? So our offer ideas feature, basically you'll just say, here's what I want. You can still go through the normal process and say, here's exactly what I want to offer. Or you can hit this offer ideas button and we'll just generate a ton of offers based on your closet and based on what we know about what you're willing to trade. So it's like, I actually, I've been testing it in test flight. I got a trade done for the Bred 4s using offer ideas. And I was able to put, I think like 8 public offers out there in like a minute and a half. Cause I was like, yeah, I'd do that. Yeah, I'd do that. So it just says, what about this offer? You tap on it. You're right there at the review screen already. If you want to change the cash or whatever, you can do that. But the idea is, hey, just tell us what you want. We'll get you to the 5-yard line and then you decide how you want to get into the end zone as opposed to having to march all the way down the field on your own. So really excited to start getting feedback on that and kind of understanding, hey, what sorts of controls would you guys like to see? How do you think we can make that experience better? You know, the ultimate goal of Tradeblock has always been to build a trade machine where it's basically like, tell us any amount of information about what you're trying to do, right? Maybe you know what you want. Maybe you know what you want to give up. Maybe you don't have an answer to either of those questions and you just know if the right trade comes along, I'm willing to make that offer. So this is sort of phase one of that bigger mission to build a trade machine that really takes a lot of the work and the thinking out of, you know, creating trades. The other thing which has existed sort of, you know, behind the curtain for a while is our bounty program. So, you know, the most important sort of like business objective for us is when a new person joins Tradeblock, we want that person to get the experience of a completed trade as fast as possible, right? Once you get over the hump, one, you understand how the system works. Two, you build a level of confidence and sort of like, I know what the process looks like end to end. And we actually have, you know, really, really healthy retention numbers, right? Like if you do a trade, the chances that you becoming a repeat trader are really high. And so we said, you know, what are different ways that we can feed that objective? And one day we were like, yo, we've got these top traders who trade 10, 20, 30 times every month. What if we just incentivize those people to seek out our new users and intentionally try to trade with them? So the bounty program basically gives top traders, you know, people who have completed the threshold will be 25 trades. If you're at 25 trades or more, you'll have this new experience where we'll say, hey, here is a bunch of offers from new users who have never traded. Here's a list of collectors, again, who have never traded. And if you complete a trade from this section of the app, you're going to get a $15 discount on that trade every time. So really saying, let's take our best traders and help that have them help us create a bunch of new traders. So
Great. Two
things that are coming out tomorrow that I'm really excited about. And then, like you said, March Mania. First, I just got to give a shout out to my co-founder, Darren, who's been running our marketing team since kind of last fall. This was, you know, totally his brainchild and he's been 100% the tip of the spear for this. But, you know, we're hoopers ourselves. Again, you know, sneaker culture and sports culture are really closely tied together. I don't know if everybody knows this, but, you know, the owners of Slam Magazine are also, you know, Trade Black investors. And so we said, hey, we basically, you know, it's unacceptable that we don't have some sort of campaign that goes along with March Madness. And so, you know, what we've done is created a sneaker bracket, and we surveyed a ton of sneakerheads, and we essentially said, hey, give us your top shoes from the past 4 years. So as you guys know, if you've ever filled out like a March Madness bracket, there are four regions. Each region has 16 teams or 17 now. So we did the same thing, but each region for us is a year. So we got, you know, basically people to tell us what were the top releases of 23, 22, 21, and 2020. We put them in a bracket. And then we basically had a committee of people, you know, sneaker aficionados, experts, people who worked in and around the industry, basically grade each matchup across, I think it was like five or six different aspects. Because, you know, what we wanted to avoid was like, hey, if you just ask people which one, like you're going to get a lot of hype, or you're going to get like which one's more valuable. So we said, how do we make this a little bit more interesting and a little bit more meaningful? You know, let's make somebody grade the storytelling of this shoe, the materials of this shoe. Hype is one of the aspects, like we can't avoid that, that's part of the culture. But yeah, so we had almost like a selection committee, almost like a, you know, college football playoff selection committee, go in and take those top 17 shoes from each year, grade them all. And that's what ultimately determined our winning bracket. So throughout the month of March, anybody who's a Trade Block user is going to be able to create one of these brackets. If anybody has a perfect bracket, there's a $25,000 grand prize. And even if nobody has a perfect bracket, there's a series of consolation prizes as well. So more than anything, we just wanted to start a conversation because, you know, what we found with Trade Block, when people post trades and are like, what side would you take? The thing that's most fascinating is the why, right? You know, 50% of people want the left side, 50% of people want the right. And the reasons are like, yo, I hate Yeezys or I love Yeezys. Oh, the storytelling behind this is amazing. I love this designer, et cetera. So we said, let's take that and let's pour a bunch of gasoline on it and create hopefully some pretty passionate debates, but also just more meaningful conversations about like, hey, why do you particularly like this shoe better than this shoe? And ultimately, you know, what do you think was the best release of the past 4 years? So that'll also be part of our release tomorrow. It'll kick off tomorrow for the beginning of March.
I'm thankful that you guys reached out to me, because if you may not know, is I've been doing the sneaker brackets for, you know, 4 or 5 years now. I usually do it at the end of the year to pick like the best sneaker of the year. And in our first discussions when we were talking about this, I was like, you know, I don't own the concept of a bracket. Anyone can make a sneaker bracket, right? I just took the same thing as you guys. I'm a big March Madness fan, and then I just applied it to that. And I started with 32, and I expanded all the way to like 64. So it's quite the big process, but I'm thankful that you guys reached out to me and I can help out with this, just because I didn't want anyone else to be like, hey, you guys are ripping off Sockjig or anything like that. He did that. And so thank you for having me, considering me is all I wanted to say.
Man, of course. And we're super, super grateful. You like, I got to give you your flowers before we, you know, before we come up on the end of the hour. Like, just the way that you and I are meeting for the first time, but I've heard a lot about you from, you know, my team. And obviously, like, I follow Sockjig. I've seen you on Twitter before. One, I just appreciate kind of like how authentically and genuinely you approach the space. You know, to your point earlier, there are a lot of folks who like are like, look, at the end of the day, I'm trying to get attention, right? The easiest way to build a big following is just to throw, you know, hot takes out there and to try to get in fights with people. And then, you know, that'll work and you'll probably make some money doing it. But it's just always so refreshing to me when I meet somebody who's like, nah, I'm just going to approach this as somebody who's really passionate. Like, my takes might not always be spicy, but they're the things that I really feel. And so I think you just bring such a healthy and genuine and like just authentic energy to the space, which is just such a good balance to a lot of the like, you know, younger provocative hype beasts that we have. And again, you know, I won't take shots at anybody. Like I think the world is beautiful because of the diversity, right? You need your yin and your yang to make each side interesting. But as we were talking to, you know, various folks about what we were doing, because we really want a bunch of people to get involved with this campaign, I can't tell you how many people were like, hey, you guys need to talk to Sockjig, like he is not only the person who has, you know, been doing this for the past few years, but everybody we talked to was like, this is one of the best guys that I know in the space. And, you know, I'm grateful I've had an opportunity to sit down and talk with you for an hour, because like, now I understand why. So hopefully this becomes, you know, the beginning of a bigger relationship, and like, maybe we do some things together from a business standpoint. But like, I'm also just big on one of the most meaningful aspects of this whole journey for me is I've just gotten to meet so many dope, interesting, good people who's like, 20 years from now, when Trayblock no longer exists, hell, maybe when Twitter no longer exists, like those relationships are going to, you know, continue to be there. So yeah, you deserve your flowers, man. I think you're very, very underappreciated in the space. And, you know, if we could have more folks like you, again, kind of balancing out a lot of what you'd expect from everywhere else, you know, I think we'd be better for it. So really excited to be, you know, partnering with you a little bit on this campaign. And yeah, I want to say thank you for being so gracious and being like, yeah, I've been doing this for the past few years, but I don't care. You know, I'm in it because I love sneakers. So if you guys want to build the, you know, the bracket this year and I just participate, like, totally fine with me. There's a lot of people who would feel some kind of way about that. So I think, again, just how gracious you were in being like, oh, totally, like that resonates a lot with me personally, and with our team. You know, that's just how we try to move.
No, thank you. And, you know, honestly, in the beginning, we were talking about kind of the origin story, and my origin story is not that different. Like, my parents came in late 60s, early 70s. I was, you know, born in Canada in a small town. I'm a brown Punjabi, Sikh Punjabi man. You know, the experience of sneakers is very different in a small town in Canada with immigrant parents. And so not everyone has the exact same story as you're talking about, like born in Cameroon and, you know, moving at a young age and, you know, go to the $45 shoes, not the $100 shoes. Like, we had the same upbringing. So it wasn't until later in life that I was able to kind of unlock a lot of this kind of stuff. And so, just to tie it to what we were talking about at the beginning, you know, not everyone has the same kind of experience growing up. But once you're there, it's a matter of, like, we're talking about, like, who you are, what you bring to the table. You can have mask on or mask off, right? And so in a lot of ways, I've shown my face, but I haven't made it part of my big identity online. But when I'm talking on there, my mask is off. I'm kind of speaking like how the things I like. And if there's things I want to be critical of, I will be critical of them too. But it's usually from not from a mean perspective or an engagement farming perspective. It's just more of a sharing my insight perspective.
You're fair, you're objective, and you're honest. I think that's the only thing that anybody can ask of anybody else. So,
all right, Meeple, thank you for being on the show. This is a great conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you ever want me back, I'm here for it. So thank you for everything you do. You know, thank you for what you bring to the community. And thank you for agreeing to work with us on this March Mania stuff. I'm super excited to see what your top pick is of the last 4 years.
Sounds good. Thanks.